Blog Talk Radio.
Again, hello and welcome to Masonic Effects. An absolute pleasure to have you sitting in with us. Somehow we managed to find more questions, more and more and more questions. Every time we think we've arrived at some small piece of the puzzle, an understanding, it opens up another level of conversation, another way of thinking. But first, I want to extend a greeting to all of you. It's a pleasure to have you sitting in with us again today. I want to share with you some things that some ideas that have been floating around over the past week, 10 days. I've been examining some really interesting, well-written documents through some research that's been talking about the future of Freemasonry. And they have, as you can imagine, some very compelling opinions about our future. I noticed that all that is written I think more emotional. It's optimistic, and I don't know if that's warranted, because it just seems to be a given that a lot of Masons, a lot of brethren have that go-to tendency. Let's get at it, but underneath the logic. The conclusions and observations and conclusions that these reports are drawing on is the sense that with a greater understanding, with a more precise understanding, there is much that we can accomplish, much that we can do to refine the decisions, to define our belief, refine our beliefs and the decisions and acts that come from them. And I think that might be the critical point here, that when we're looking at the state of Masonry, wherever we happen to be, whether it's the celebration of the you know, seeing the Grand Master take the balcony with his cousin, the Queen, on her Platinum Jubilee, or 70th Jubilee. We have many reminders that much of what Masonry has been doing and been able to do, the contributions, have gone unnoticed. I'm not professing, you know, billboards beside the road, or you know, ads for initiation, mass initiation ceremonies. I'm not an advocate of that type of thinking at all. What is interesting is this sense that our order has had a bearing on the cultures and societies around us through the years. Now, I know church and state have examined this very, very carefully, and you know, you've all read the papal bulls of condemnation and the concerns at various times by political authority that something subversive might be going on in these secret societies that needs to be controlled by the state, or ought to be controlled by the state, or understood more clearly by the state. This is, and that kind of thinking is always there. There is some legitimacy to the question, because we are, after all, quite capable of demonstrating the legitimacy of our order, periodically that's necessary for us to take that step. But the influence, I live in a world where I've been to parts of congregations and church groups where the people around me evidently, I didn't go in looking for this, but evidently couldn't describe what the faith was that they were practicing, or why it was distinct from any other. And it raises an interesting question, because when you see that and think, well, these folks around me don't seem to be too bothered by that, understanding the distinction of their practices, it just is. It's an assumption that's taken for granted. But did that make any of the people any less devout in the room? I don't know that. But it is an interesting observation, and I think, and it's a fair one. It's a fair one. It doesn't do well. If I think about it just generally, if we're bouncing along the pathway, there's nothing that compels each one of us to understand the with any sense of logic or with any sense of reflection an examination of our beliefs. Is our belief enough? Well, it is. If I say it's enough, then it's enough. But is it partial? Is it complete? Is it a fragment of information? Is it an observation? Is it an echo? Am I repeating something that I've heard other people say because of some type of moral calculation that my mind is making? That there's some advantage. Well, if I got into that, then we're opening up this whole world of examining the motivator. What's motivating us? Well, at one point I would have said that what motivates us is this sense of what our nature has much to do with, this essential sense of depression and anxiety that lies at the heart of us. And I don't think so anymore. That was when I was younger. and probably feeling depressed and anxious. I think the essential nature has much more to do with curiosity and examination. This constant flirtation with the unknown, trying to, you know, understand, and from that to be able to predict. Well, we don't. I'm in an environment, a culture where we've allocated that task. The way that we can come to terms with predictability is to think about the tools that we have, that science allows us to predict in a sense, mathematics and chemistry and geometry. The drive, the what is I think at the heart or contributed largely to the landmarks of Freemasonry has something to do with this need for truth. Not to mix that up with some kind of crazy morality, but I think the word that for me comes to mind when I hear that is accuracy. Do I want to end the question? Am I satisfied bouncing through life with half notions and thinking things that are being influenced by things that aren't true? Creating my own patterns of belief so that I'm satisfied. I can satisfy myself. But then that comes to I think if you follow the logic here a little bit, if it follows that that eventually we're going to find belief on one hand, faith on one hand, and fact, truth. And isn't that? I'm not thinking good or bad, although I've met some people that do, black and white, but is that even a choice for us, for the more devout amongst us who accept that the charge that we're going to be guided by these very compelling fields of thinking, science and arts. Truth is beauty. Beauty is truth. You know, that kind of kickstart. Are still going to be able to and ought to be examining the premise. And I put it to you, what is wrong if I have fanciful beliefs, if they don't impact on anybody else, that I make up this fantastical explanation for doing what I do? And out of that, out of my own willpower, I declare that out of that, it means that I'm quite a good fellow. And I can stay a good fellow as long as I maintain the status quo. And where I find that tension, where there's confusion, where questions are put to me, where I haven't prepared an answer, it's quite easy enough to avoid all of that, isn't it? Quite easy to do that. The days, and I think old men have the advantage because we can do that. We can, if we don't pay much attention, if we think that there comes a time where I'm just oozing with opinions, it means I've stopped really thinking. My opinions are going to be the answer for what's going on ahead. And whatever question you ask me, I'm going to have an opinion about it. Much, much different than the tedium of examining the question to understand what the person asking it is trying to achieve. And whether what I'm saying is simply a belief that I may not be aware, or if there is some truth to it, is it valid or does it have any bearing if I don't acknowledge it? If I start off with things like, you know, years ago, I was affected by Plato's Republic, and I had no, or truly, honestly, I had no idea. I had this sense, self-driven epiphany that I don't know as much as the people that I'm seeing. I don't know as much. They're all experts around me, and not to be smug about it, but, you know, it was an assumption that opened up so many doors. When people came in a state of confusion, they were still more expert about themselves than I was about them. They having been with themselves every second, every minute of every day and every. I'd had, of course, those of you will see how awkward they, I know what I don't know. I'm the least knowledgeable of all in the room. You know, well, yeah, I'm not going to assume that just because I locked the idea in my mind and lost track of the source of it that it's self-generated, but it makes sense, and I found that as a truth that while I'm a part of a world that likes to pretend that all is calm and a calming definition, a soothing definition is all that's needed to take away the nasty bits temporarily. And just that temporary relief is all that's important. Well, after a time, you had to think, well, we can do that, and a lot of us do. We build whole cultures around that. What in the hell has happened to a sense of contentment and a sense of compassion or altruism? Are the values that matter to most people in the world? Not to say there's people that are fighting back against oppression. Yeah, that's part of the world that we live into. And can we have no magic wand. This isn't the Harry Potter's college where we're going to learn how to create magic. Can't make the ill will and history disappear. We can't. We can't even ignore it because it haunts us. But we can understand it and understand our own nature, our own fragility. When we talk, every single conversation that we have is not necessarily intense. But where do we have those more learned conversations? Where in your life? Where's the environment that you are drawn to when you want to examine values and different propositions and have an understanding how you're doing? And to arrive at that understanding, of course, we want to listen to the people around us. I like to think that I wanted and needed to be influenced by men who have far more to far on the ball than I do, far more a sense of detail that that it's not about agreeing. It's about understanding the influence of being around people that are searching for knowledge and understanding and how to apply it. But I don't know if I would put the cap on just quite yet. I don't think, because that, you know, most people will run away if they see, oh my, hear that conversation again. I don't want to be part of that. It's like, oh. So we do what friends have done for a long, long time, and friends advisedly. When friends sit down, they may not do, they don't necessarily have to have the destination mind. The journey is so much fun. You, wherever you start, if you're going to have a serious conversation, you do it with friends, because they'll match you. They'll respond. They're okay with it. They're not going to sit there and judge you. So simple kind of stuff that school children learn. And I think old men can rethink it too. And today I'm trying to illustrate a few of these points. The commentary certainly weighing the advantage of truth. I think that's an interesting. I find it very interesting. The poetry I've chosen to. I've chosen Robert Burns' work, the Scottish 18th century poet, for reasons that I think may be of interest to us, beyond the nostalgia, beyond the fact that. What do we know him for? Two poems, maybe three, Auld Lang Syne, Ode to a Haggis, that kind of thing. There's more to him, much, much more to him. And today I'm going to share a poem that he wrote about masonry. It's a bit of a departure. I certainly would apologize to anyone that thinks that only the orthodoxy that only can do any have any validity. Can you imagine if that were the case? We'd have everybody would be operating in these little silos, wouldn't it? Only bakers can study baking. Only engineers can study engineering. Pick one. Only chemists can study, have any validity about a pharmacy. You can see the absurdity of it pretty quickly. But an opportunity to catch our breath together again, to acknowledge, you know, there's a lot going on. I like to think that we don't lose track. It's easy enough to lose track of influence. But in your own way, in your own small way, without declaring and drawing attention, the influence that you bring, the being able to take other people's opinions seriously, I think is an enormous advantage in a world that wants to define us as broken and divided and angry. There are those. But there's something else going on. There is that collective consciousness. It's collective. It's out there. Here, I'll prove it. Bill Evans. Lovely man, lovely music. Bill Evans, that's from sessions he did in Paris. Weighing the advantage of truth. It's not easy. Truth isn't pretty, I don't think, necessarily. Unless you find that sense of these models of thinking that are beautiful, that are exquisite, so well organized in our thinking. At the least, we could modestly think there is a time when truth is not evident, even to the greatest mind amongst us. In that state of liminal thought, would we seem willing to rush to declare a belief as ersatz truth? I don't know, so I'm just going to declare it. Without being too concerned, it is even a complete deep belief. Partial will do. When we speak about ethics and morality, we are talking about reasoning and belief itself. I think. For those who haven't given it a second thought, we swore to uphold the fact that fact was superior to belief. Easier said than done, yes, of course. We know one to be sustainable while the other is situational. Once upon a time, when we looked up at the sky, we only saw 7 moving objects of light. The heavens unlocked when a telescope was invented. And still today, we probe light from our beginnings, 13.8 billion years ago. The timelines aside, tell me, what is the downside of knowing truth? Is it any more difficult knowing than presuming? I like watching a magician work her illusions. The lady is being sawed in half. I saw it. An elephant has really disappeared from the stage. It floated away. The rabbit came at you. The hat. How did that? Tricks, illusions. Eh? Tricking the senses is fun when we deliberately allow it to happen. It's a joy. Ah, I love bunnies. Opinions are close cousins to truth that coexist comfortably until we are building a calculus. FM, Freemasonry is not exclusive, but it does offer worthwhile maxims that enhance a way of thought among the variety. We either use or don't use them. We either ask or don't ask questions of ourselves. Some are naturally talented, but most of us need to blend what talent we have with hard work to improve our skills while still respecting nature and natural and knowing that somebody is embellishing. At the end of the day, we want to know we are capable of leaving behind what we were and embracing our contributions honestly and modestly. Can you imagine being in the company of 6 others who also value influence over control? Imagine what they would accomplish. They are out there. They're looking for you as you are looking for them. Where to look? I needed something Canadian. And that was a throwback to my formative years. Happy music. Chuck Mangione. Nice. Thank you, Chuck. I'm not sure Chuck is still with us, but thank you, man. I want to be careful here now. I want to be careful. I want to influence an opinion. I want to influence your opinion. I'm going to attempt to blatantly to share the ideas of somebody that paid attention. I hate that. That attention to detail. Oh, isn't that the point of all of our research, all of our knowledge, is that observation and what it tell, and then just describing it. When you make those observations, you describe in best you can what it is that you're seeing. And over and over and over. It's like, the imagination is like fractal geometry. It's not, Euclidean exists, but so does this geometry, this fractal. So Mandelbrot's work, fascinating. And I equate that to thinking, because it seems to embrace imagination and a mathematics that is it was there to be discovered, and my goodness, we're all the beneficiaries of that in some small way. Here, I'm having a moment of nostalgia here about the place where my roots were established in Scotland before hundreds of years ago. My family came to this country hundreds of years, 1797. Yeah, but we still remember. So as you, wherever you your roots are, you remember those roots. They won't necessarily define you today. You're much more, of course, much more. But to embrace the essence of your culture and the experiences as you remember them, not as verbatim as you have at best a slight impression of what was going on. Five of us standing around watching something happening are going to have five different opinions. This guy is interesting because he's studied, and we can learn from it, and it doesn't really lend itself to the world of masonologists. You know, within the fabric of the craft, the only people that have any credibility are Freemasons. Well, I guess if we want to say that's a declaration that would close the Louvre and close the Hermitage and close the doors to the Royal Society, all the museums. If only Masons, if the characteristic is Mason, then I would suggest to you, is that mean the complete Mason, the true Mason, the ideal Mason, or your version, or my version? Who decides that? Is it constitutionally determined? Are truths now being sanitized by constitutional proofs and consistency? Well, I thought we went through that. Wasn't that 15th century stuff? Didn't the Renaissance help us to step away from that kind of thinking? And certainly, didn't the period of the Enlightenment help us to begin to build, to continue to build with on those ideas, the reexamination of assumption. Burns does that for us. But he was a writer and a thinker before he was a Freemason. And the benefit, the smart within you, the intelligence within you, might be complemented by Masonry, but it isn't the Freemasonry isn't the Kool-Aid. You don't drink it and then become something else. No, this is a man that had bearing. We like to think, and it was been promoted that this is a very innocent, not a very well-educated person. And he played that. He knew that people that would open up doors if people. He was more humble than they. So for a long time, we learned that, and many of us learned that. The address to the hangar. So you think about, where did he come up with this language? He's lovely. And we know about the criticism. He was a common Scots. So who would use that language? That's a lost language even then. And yet he did. He was bold enough. But it was niche, wasn't it? Nobody else was doing it for a lot of reasons, but this fella did it. And he used the dialect, the common, so-called common dialect. But this guy is considered. There's some contradictions about this guy. Many, many things. He was very complex. There's very little that's simple about this guy. He played up the image of this simple bard, and, unbroken by the rules of art. But he was very, very, in fact, he was very well-read and a cultivated individual. He was schooled by a private tutor when he was younger, John Murdoch, who'd been hired by his dad. And despite occasional claims to possess little learning, Burns parades his education. Yeah. In a famous letter to author and travel writer Dr. John Moore, August 1787, for example, he displays a strong familiarity with the literary greats such as William Shakespeare, John Milton, John Locke, Alexander Pope, Tobias Smollett. Not exactly names that you find carved into the table at a pub. And when he died, he left a very extensive library. He was a reader. He was absorbing information. And when he absorbed it, let's be kind and perhaps be more truthful about the man. He was humbled and knew what he didn't know. So as they say, he played up the image of the simple bard, unbroken by the rules of art. But in fact, could he well have just been realizing that there's so much more to learn and so many more people out there that are able to contribute to his learning. But another myth that grew up around him was his fondness for drink. We know that he liked to socialize, convivial character, as we will say, and it's celebrated in his poems and songs. But in the wake of his death in 1796, the biographers began to exaggerate his intemperance. He became a character, a little cap askew, a bit of a buzz going all the time. 1797, a memoir by the journalist John Heron made inflated claims about his supposed moral dissipation. While the editor of the influential and highly successful first collected works of the poet James Currie attributed Burns' death to alcoholism. These myths may reflect the biographer's sympathies more than those of their subject. Heron was prone to dissipation himself. Currie was a physician and teetotaler. Don't you love being around teetotalers? One myth that may have more of a foundation is the fact that he was had a weakness for the opposite sex. Burns fathered some 13 children by at least 5 different women. The majority of these children were born out of wedlock, and although some were legitimized when Burns finally made Jean Amour his wife, his famous affair with Agnes Maglios, or Clarinda, produced a renowned series of love letters, as well as one of the finest love songs ever written. It's called A Fond Kiss. However, in this case, his love didn't stop him from seducing Cleo's maid, Jenny Clough, who had a child by the poet or songwriter. He's known the world over as a leading poet, but much of his prodigious output consisted of songs. He lived a short yet productive life. Much of his energy, particularly towards the latter end of his career, was spent collecting, reworking, and writing new lyrics for existing songs. Burns was the main contributor to the editor James Johnson's Scots Musical Museum, a leading collection of Scots songs from the period. Scots, hey. Here's the poem that I'm going to share with you today is Farewell to the Brethren of St. James Lodge, Tarbolton. Now, he wrote this when he was making arrangements for leaving the country. They were just about complete, so he sat down and wrote this poem. And he was to start the journey immediately. So his relations with the Brethren of St. James Lodge seemed to have been a particular enjoyable nature, and the parting would have been sorrowful one for all of them. But the separation was spared. He didn't separate. He didn't move away. But the poem, the Farewell to the Brethren, the verses remain for the enjoyment of us. Now, this is beautiful. He was able to say goodbye like this. This is a goodbye that I think maybe if we're thinking about the next time we say goodbye or our parting, maybe we'll be influenced and remember some of these phrases, these thoughts. Adieu, a heartwarm, fond adieu. Dear brothers of the mystic tie, ye favored, enlightened few, companions of my social joy, though I to foreign land must tame, pursuing fortune's siddlery bag, with melting heart and brimful eye, I mind you still, though far away. Oft have I met your social band and spent the cheerful festive night off, honored with supreme command, presided o'er the sons of light, and by that hieroglyphic bright, which none but craftsmen ever saw, strong memory in my heart shall write those happy scenes when far away. May freedom, harmony, and love unite you in the grand design, beneath the omniscient eye above, the glory architect divine, when you may keep an unerring line still rising from the plummet's law, till order bright completely shine shall be my prayer when far away. And you, farewell, whose merits claim justly the highest badge to wear. Heaven bless your honored noble name to masonry and Scotia, dear. At last, request, permit me here that when yearly ye assemble, one round I ask it with a tear to him, one round the bard that's far away. Think of me, remember me, when I'm gone. Thank you. You know, Dave Brobeck, nice material, nice history. I've often talked about the benefits of unvarnished history, not the spin, you know, but, and this is another deep dive. This is the kind of observation that over the years, I absolutely enjoy the truth. Because it makes us appear not so superior, not so pious, but part of the struggle, or as the elites would say, the commonness of us all. You know, I've been raised in a world where the social class was somehow superior to, according to rank. Until, oh my goodness, the gentry, who were a bit clueless, needed merchants, needed those people that had to actually work for a living, to bail them out, financially. How many kings went on bended knee to the mercantile? To say, well, look, I need money. They won't say I wasted it all, but the treasury is empty, and I want to go to war, and so I need your support. Of course, in exchange for what? And so it goes on and on and on. Let's think that there's been enough time between the writing of this. You know, we're looking at 18th century, and it's far enough away. It's in the Netherlands, so that we can detach ourselves. So this is not in any way going to be tainting our sense of superiority. You know, it begins here
with a statement that I find, I would like to see this over the door of lodges. More such important work require brothers carefully chosen with similar values and mores. I can't agree with a more accurate statement. This is so important. Select carefully. It's very important. And to select and choose using those similar values. And then that means the people doing it need to be aware of their values and our values. We're talking about household rules here, and thank goodness Le Bien-Aimé made the record, had such beautiful records. They made clear, remember, we're talking about this influential old lodge in the Netherlands. But now we're going to look at some of the housekeeping here. Household rules that once admitted, brothers were required to be punctual and attendance was rigorously demanded with fines imposed for absence. You know how popular that would have been, just about as popular as it is today. And when those fines proved controversial and threatened to impair the harmony of the lodge, they were removed, and an annual fee of 24 guilders was put in the place. Dues. So how would a lodge generate money? Fans for fooling around it. Eventually, in place of a system of black and white beans used for voting by ballot, a system using coins, probably imitating the practices of the old local guilds, was adopted. Moreover, in at least one other lodge, fines were also imposed for immoral behavior, excessive card playing, sleeping away from home in places of ill repute, lingering at the lodge after it was formally closed. The beneficiaries of immorality were to be the poor, into whose box the fines were put. Sometime in the 19th century, Dutch Freemasons went through their own old records and came up with a list of men who had been excluded from all the 18th century lodges and the reasons for the exclusions. Tantalizingly brief, they include outrageous behavior and unruly behavior, as well as dereliction in dues payments. Dozens of men were banned or excluded from the 1750s to the 1790s. In other words, there was a value, eh? By the late 1750s, the legitimacy as well as the discipline of Le Bien-Aimé was firmly established. They were making an effort, eh? And they were reactive. You know, we'll fine you, but when everyone said, no, that ain't going to happen, he said, all right, we'll come up with something different. In addition, Dutch Freemasonry in general had begun to assume a national identity. Its Grand Master could now speak of les frères députés de loge respectives qui ont assisté le symbole national Tim et le Hay. Yeah, I think I captured that, didn't I? At these national assemblies held in The Hague, the ceremonies placed brothers standing in rows, first symbolizing the Staten van Holland, that is, the States of Holland, the body that had once condemned the order, and which could be described as the legislative body of the province. Behind them stood other brothers, described as representing the national Grand Master. Finally, standing in back of them were the officers of the lodge, visitors, and all the other brothers, all of whom they joined in the communal singing that was so much a part of Masonic ritual. Now, you notice a lot of these things we've removed or we don't practice anymore. And you wonder, has it been purposeful that we don't do that? Or, you know, is that something that we can look at? The idea of giving to the poor, I like that. And the leverage that it's based on the behavior or, you know, something good. You're being fined because you're ridiculous. But the money isn't going to somebody's pocket, or it's not going to buy a can of paint for the walls. It's going to be given to people that are in need. There's a connection, and it's teaching us these connections. Now, would we be, I guess we can always think about, you know, those days. And is there anything to learn, anything to benefit us? And I know some of you out there will be looking with a raised eyebrow. Why are you asking? We still have, you know, those what you're describing here in Holland is still familiar. Well, in a lot of practices, in a lot of lodges, it isn't. There's been a confusion, a great deal of confusion, and now the risk here is irrelevance. And for a very, very long time, we've paid little attention to that where I am, my part of the Masonic environment, this community. And it's not to say we can't restore it. It's simply to understand whether we could learn from those early examples, and I don't know if we want to become a reenactment of we're going to put on old uniforms and reenact the past battles. I don't exactly think that's going to carry a lot of weight with the thinkers, the people out there that are looking for an opportunity for the dialogue. And I think arrived at from a sense of confidence, but not conjecture. I hope a sense today that that's familiar. The world that we live in is familiar. We can look at, and we do, because it helps us to understand. We can look at stereotypes, but we need to keep in mind that it's not. When we pull out an aspect of masonry, it's a distortion from what is. Masonry is a way of thinking. It's not one way of thinking, and it doesn't really lend itself to strong opinion, because we're taught values and ethics. And the point of all of that is to be able to calculate at a given time, you know, for the black is black and white is white. Sometimes that black and white answer doesn't fit. It's not the best. When we apply a sense of ethic, we make a calculation of sorts, so that our morality isn't a matter of convenience, so that in a given situation, we have arrived at an ethically calculated, an ethical sense of what is right or wrong. That is not the kind of behavior or the kind of action for every man, every person. And it's not meant to curry favor. It's doing the right thing. That's never been highly praised. And you want to fit in. Let's do it. Keep the complications out. If only life could be simplified. I hope you come back, and we'll try and simplify it more next week. And I hope we've served some purpose for you. Thank you for tuning in, particularly new listeners from Africa and and Ireland and the Netherlands and Germany and China. I think we still have occasional visitors from China, although I'm not really sure about their. I hope we open up their mind and thinking. And I think we see overlap with our values in a lot of places. North America, thank you very much. UK, our followers there, and Australia, absolutely. So pleased to have you sitting in. I look forward to having you join us next week. And in the meantime, commit those acts of Masonic random kindness. Thank you.